Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin is home to the nation's only Master Cheesemakers program that provides innovative cheesemakers with continuing education opportunities? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Hey, thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. This is Katie, HRN Executive Director, and I'm so excited to share with you our coverage from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival.
We are here live today at Charleston Wine and Food.
Join us as we talk all things food.
Come to Charleston, eat some seafood. Eat all of the seafood.
Chicken fried chicken with chorizo steak and salsa verde mashed potatoes.
So quintessentially like Southern fare at its finest.
And have important conversations.
We're also talking about professional women in restaurants and how underrepresented they are, people of color in restaurants, and how they're not talked about.
We get real with Food Network's Manit Chauhan.
Balance is BS. I was told that I wasn't going to be bleeped out.
And find out about raising sugarcane with Chef Sean Brock.
It's like being Indiana Jones or something. You never know what you're going to find.
You'll come away inspired by the power of food and the food scene in Charleston. Here's Dr. Jessica B. Harris.
Food is constantly in flux. Food is always moving. Food is the only real lingua franca that we have that allows us to connect with other folks.
So tune in to Heritage Radio Network on tour at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't go wrong.
This is Sam Benrubi from the Grape Nation. We had an opportunity to go down to the Naples Winter Wine Festival and talk to a bunch of different winemakers. This interview is with David and Callum Powell from Powell & Son Winery in the Barossa in Australia.
Welcome to the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network, your weekly wine journey. We are at the Naples Winter Wine Festival, benefiting the Naples Children and Education Foundation. Our guests are David and Callum Powell from Powell & Son Wines in the Barossa Valley in Australia. I'm excited to have these guys on because they're doing some great stuff and making some incredible wines. And I want to welcome David and Callum to the Grape Nation. Thanks for coming on.
Pleasure.
Thanks.
I think it would be a good thing if you guys spent a few minutes with a little background in history. Now, David, I know, you know, you started as a lumberjack in Scotland. I mean, we could buzz through that quickly. But, you know, let's get to the wine thing and talk about that.
That part of it was important because that's actually where I met a little Scottish girl who ended up being Callum's mother.
Who became your wife,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, so at the end of the day, that's probably, you know, where it all began in a way. So anyway, went home, ended up starting Tourbreck, long story short. Ran Tourbreck for 20-odd years.
What, just context, what year did it start about?
Well, officially the first wines were released in 97 from the 95 vintage. Started the business about 92.
Right.
Getting vineyards, making wine, stuff like that. Then some years later, 2013, I left my own company. That's a long story. But the silver lining was that my elder son had always been pretty keen to get into the business. Used to follow me around like a bad smell when he was a kid. When he was three, I'd turn around in the winery and tread on him. So he was always there behind me. And so Callum said to me, he said, "Dad, you know, I didn't really ever want to take over Tourbreck anyway. That was your gig. So let's start together."
So Callum, were you doing any other wine things? I mean, did you travel, do harvests or intern?
Yeah, I did.
You know,
did
cut your teeth?
At that stage, 2013 was my gap year. I just finished high school the year before.
Okay.
So I was actually lucky enough to go and work in Hermitage for a guy called John Lee Sharp. So I spent about 10
kind of right to the top, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So that was quite incredible. So that really left... It was pretty impactful for me.
So is it obvious, because Australian wines are known to be Syrah, Shiraz-based, that you send them to Hermitage to a Syrah-based wine with Shiraz?
Say, if you speak to California winemakers who make Syrah and the Shiraz, you know, that's the home. I mean, that's not where the grape came from originally, but certainly these days, for where we've last 500 years, that's where we think of the variety coming from.
Right.
And John Louis and his wife Erin are very dear friends of mine, but not just that. You know, the Chard family are the family of Syrah.
Really?
And I wanted Callum to go, you know, in the new world, people use terms like Terroir and Vigneron as marketing terms.
Right.
But they have no fucking idea what they really mean.
Right.
But I wanted Callum to go to realise, sorry, you said like a twist, is that okay?
Yeah.
I won't use my favourite word in the English language. Yeah. That might be a bit much for your listeners.
I wouldn't tell you if you couldn't.
Yeah. But, you know, so I wanted Callum to learn that that was the real thing, that it actually meant something.
So you start. Well, let's go back. So you're at Torbrick for a bunch of years,
yep,
with high critical acclaim.
Yep.
You know, Parker fell in love with the wines. You really stood out in Australia. I think you helped. I don't know if the words put Australia on the map again,
well,
but
yeah,
I think you were one of the impetuses of really turning out and not necessarily in the most traditional way. Mm-hmm. You know, you as a personality, the type of wines, all of that stuff. So like you said, that comes to an end. You can go and Google if you want to find out more. So what was it, around 2014, you guys pretty much kicked up Powell and Son?
That was the first vintage, that's right.
So you said earlier, the inspiration is, listen, my kid's into this. This is where I came from. Let's do it. Tell me more about that.
Well, it was interesting because... Callum came home and I, you know, was having all sorts of legal stuff to sort out and it was kind of messy and stuff. I had to actually stay out of it until 2015. That's a long story I won't bother going into.
Everything's a long story with you.
Oh, trust me. I don't know what I did in my former life. Trust me. I must have killed someone's cat or something. But I, you know, when Callum came to me, he didn't just say, you know, Dad, let's do something together. And he said, I'm not just coming for Rod. I want to be an equal partner in this. So he talked a lot about what we were going to do as far as the wine style we wanted to make. Callum then proceeded at the ripe age of 19 to tell me what I'd been doing wrong at Torbrick and how I could do it better. And trust me, he's probably one of the few people on the planet that's actually told me that sort of stuff and lived to tell the tale. But he was right. You know, he talked about the freshness of the wine, how we could, the élevage, how we could age the wines, how we could do it differently using larger format oak rather than smaller.
Good, new, fresh, sort of different
stuff.
Perspective.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So... your dad told me before the interview that he would give you 3 minutes of amnesty, and he asked me to ask you that if you're not enjoying this or you made a mistake, that on this show you could leave the winery.
Okay.
Do you want to stay or go?
Are you happy with this?
Okay, so we got that.
Well, the interesting thing is now that he's come home from university, he's decided that even though Callum designed the label and everything, he's actually decided that perhaps should be called Powell and Father rather than Powell and Son.
Oh, here we go.
So I don't think he's going anywhere.
Getting big balls early.
Yeah, you know? I don't think he's going anywhere.
All right, so let's talk about the wines. I mean, is it fair to say you guys are Rhonists? I mean, a lot of the wines that you make are Rhone varietals.
Yeah, we are. It's a sort of very strange coincidence. I mean, the Barossa Valley originally was planted to make fortified wines. That was where our industry came from in the 1800s to supply the English market, which was, we were still a colony. So it just happened to be a very happy coincidence that the most populous varieties planted in the Barossa, which is where the whole thing started for us, and for Australia as the fortified supply to the UK, the varieties they planted were what we call Matara and Vedra, Grenache.
Right.
Shiraz was actually the poor cousin, funnily enough, because it wasn't the best fortified variety, whereas things like Grenache and Shiraz and
were better.
Other ones were better. So it just happened that, and then with no Phylloxera, as you know, a lot of your listeners may know, no Phylloxera in the Barossa.
Right.
100 and something years later, we've got these amazing old vines.
Plant disease that could knock out.
Well, it's a little aphid that basically attaches itself
it's
to the
bug
roots.
A bug or
sucks
a fly.
Well, it's like a little aphid, but it
attaches itself
to the roots and sucks all the goodies out, yeah.
So, because, you know, I just double-check my research, and you look at a lot of wineries in Australia, and they don't have the diversity of Rhone varieties. You know, it's the typical. I mean, you really... you know, stretch out.
Well, once again, I think it's a climatic thing. I mean, the You know, Shiraz, Syrah, whatever you like to call it, is quite versatile. So you can make it in really hot places like the Australian Riverland and pretty good commercial wines. Then warmer places like Barossa Valley, McLaren Vale, but you can make it in cooler places. I mean, there's some great Syrah, I say Syrah intentionally because it's more that style, coming out of Tasmania, which is quite cool. So whereas things like Grenache and Matara, you try and grow them in a cool area, you'll never get them right. So that's probably why we have that, you know, sort of concentration of those varieties.
So as far as the source of the grapes, you're sourcing from outside sources.
We don't own any vineyard. But
is that an aspiration? I mean, you have your eye now.
One thing at a time. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. No, I get that, and it's not an easy, cheap proposition.
I literally left my own company after 20 years with a shirt on my back. So we're sort of.
But you know, winemakers are so particular. You want to have control over your own.
Exactly, and that's really, you know, we had a long time to kind of sit down and think and talk about what we wanted to do. And one of the things that both of us are really big on is, any vineyards that we were going to deal with and make wine from, we had to have full control. And not only that, but we did all the work ourselves. And so we've now got 6 vineyards that we deal with, and all of those vineyards, we do the pruning, we do all the summer work, everything ourselves.
So you have control of them.
Absolutely. That's the whole
point. I mean, they're partnerships you're paying, but...
That was the part of
the
thing.
So that's the closest thing to...
Yeah.
Having a partner that'll let you, you know, do yields and pruning and all that, right? Your style and everything.
That was one of the parameters. I mean, we don't make a lot of wine. We make a fraction of what I used to make at Torbrick, and that's intentional. But we only make wine off vineyards we run ourselves. That's not true. There's one grower who was my first ever grower at Torbrick, one of my closest friends. He's forgotten more about dry and grape growing than I'll ever know. So we take fruit from him. Funnily enough, even he's 70s, he's actually gone biodynamic, which is kind of interesting considering he was born at 14 and he's semi-literate, and I don't mean that in a bad way. But so that's the one vineyard we don't run ourselves. But as I said, I could never run a vineyard as well as he does. But
and we mentioned Barossa, but you also source grapes from the Edna Valley, right?
Edna Valley, yeah.
Eden or
Eden? Eden. Yeah, Edna's down near Paso.
Eden Valley.
That's all right. No, a lot of people.
My bad. What grapes are you growing and vintning there?
All right. So in Eden Valley, I mean, it's that's the thing about what people don't get about the Barossa is you've really got the two valleys within the region, you know. And the Barossa Valley is definitely the style of the Barossa Valley Shiraz is definitely better known. You know, it's a richer, more voluptuous style, and you know, that comes down to a lot of factors, but it's predominantly the warmth, the lower altitude, the lower rainfall, and you've got a lot of heavy clay soils and ironstone, and you get that concentration of fruit. Whereas in the Eden Valley, you're generally 200 to 300 metres higher in altitude.
So higher altitude.
That's right. You get higher rainfall. It's much cooler.
Wetter.
You get
different soils. Breezes.
And the soils, I mean, the soils vary a lot, but as a wide generalisation, you get much more shallow, loamy soils, and then a lot of stone and bedrock. So you've got bits and pieces of granite through there, lots of quartz and schist, and so really, really different styles of wine. So
characterize some of the styles. Are they more austere or?
Certainly more austere. So
they're not as voluptuous and rich as the Barossa.
Which was our point.
Which is a style you don't mind making, I'm sure, or having the opportunity, right?
Well, I always kind of say, you know, Barossa Valley Shiraz is the girl you want to go to bed with, and the Eden Valley Shiraz is the one you want to wake up with in the morning and take to meet your mum, you know?
Get it both ways. I buy a bottle of each.
Well,
kind of hard proposition.
Somebody once said we should blend the two, which we do in one of our wines. Yeah, you got to be careful what you wish for, though, you know?
So you brought up a word before, biodynamic, which was one of your growers. So you control the vineyards. What's your approach? I mean, are you low intervention?
Absolutely.
Minimalist?
Tell me about
how you farm and how you vent.
Well, that's why we wanted to run the vineyards. We are actually farming organically, and we happy to accept some of the biodynamic principles. I mean, I think there's a lot of good stuff, particularly the discipline. I think some of it gets a bit carried away.
Yeah.
And the biggest
problem, ram's horn thing?
I once actually jokingly said to someone, you know, white man only turned up in Australia 250 years ago. So before then, there was no cloven-hoofed animals, so no horns. So
Why now?
Forget the fact the grapevines weren't there anyway. So I said to someone, if you want to be a biodynamic farmer and in Australia, you have to go to an indigenous burial ground and dig up their didgeridoos and fill it with kangaroo poo. So I think it all gets a bit silly.
It's a little crazy.
What annoys me more, though, is that people say, oh, my wine's biodynamic, my wine's organic. Yeah, but is it any good? I don't care how you know, as long as you're not nuking it with chemicals.
I mean, the overall idea of sustainable and responsible growing is absolutely great, but that doesn't mean anything, like you said. I mean, you could be a crappy grower, crappy vintner, you know, you don't know what you're doing.
But
afterwards,
it's important that, you know, these vineyards have been there a long time, that we're not building up more crap in the soil that was done for a long time in the, you know, in the 70s and 80s.
Were you, when you were at Torbrick, similar practices?
Pretty much. Although I think
that was always your belief.
It's sustainability, and we're probably working more towards that. You know, at Toolbrook, I was probably used a bit more herbicide and a bit more systemic spray.
You're doing less.
But now we're doing as literally as little as we can.
Is it more challenging? I mean, are you dealing with more pests, or it's a way of life and you work it that way because it's the better way?
You really just have to pay more attention, I think. And that's the beautiful thing about what we're doing, is we don't have many vineyards, you know? And so we really can pay a lot of attention to what we've got. But I think if organic or biodynamic principles can be applied anywhere in the world, they can definitely be applied to the Barossa Valley, you know? It is a dry, warm place, you know, there's really low risk of things like botrytis or rot, so it's not that difficult. Whereas if you're in a cooler climate, it'd be a much more difficult thing to do.
Right.
And so for us, it seemed like a no-brainer, to be honest.
Right, so let's talk about the wines. The wines are called Powell & Son. You make some uber-premium wines, you know, at the prices don't scare me or other people, because there's plenty of wines out there for more, and I'm sure the time and everything put into it warrants that. Talk to me about, you know, the wines that are coming to market or in the market. Well, and let's talk about, you know, let's do some promotion here. Where, you know, restaurants, you know, online, you know, stores.
We, once again, when we started the thing, Callum and I talked a lot about what we were going to do, what sort of portfolio we were going to build and so on. And we wanted to make, and it might sound arrogant, but we wanted to basically create a Barossa version or Australian version of Domaine and Romney Conti. You know, get them six amazing vineyards, make incredibly terroir-driven wines, single vineyard, single varietal, and really do a number.
Because you're talking Rhone grapes versus Burgundy.
Well, yeah,
you're
talking, I'm not talking about...
No, I know. Yeah. I know, but what made that brand, the practices are so admirable.
Yeah.
It's like, let's be the DRC
Absolutely. I'm sure Orbit of Lyon would actually probably want to throw something at me or laugh at me when he hears me saying that. But I'm just saying, that's the model, and... You know, I hope he's not
so offended. So on a scale of this starting and this being there, in your mind, getting to that goal, where are you?
Well, I mean, I'm not DRC pricing. But
your mind.
Well, I think we're already doing it. I mean, that's one of the things that surprised me when I left Toolbrick, is that, you know, I'm good at what I do. Callum's learned a hell of a lot in a short time for a young bloke. So that's not the hard bit. The hard bit's getting the fruit. And I was so happy when I realised how easily it was for us to actually get together a parcel of vineyards that was sort of absolutely perfect for what we wanted.
How long did that take? I mean, do you have to run around for a year or so?
It's funny because
you knew people.
It's kind of like, other people knew people, and it's sort of like the Barossa's a small place, you know, and everybody knew what was going on. A lot of people
once word got out
what was going on and what had really happened and stuff. But the other thing is, apart from that, so that set of wines, which is six wines, but we also make what we call our regional wines. Because we wanted wines that people can drink, enjoy. You know, it's all very nice selling wine to collectors, and we love doing that for certain prices.
Slow down for one sec, go back. The wines we just talked about are the
single vineyard wines.
The single vineyard, and everyone makes them, cost a little higher, special, limited, you know, availability and all that. And then you make a larger quantity, high quality, more available.
And more reasonably priced.
Right.
Now, remember, at Toolbrick, at maximum, I think we got 100,000 cases. We make 10,000. So when we say, you know, we make a wine that we only sell in our export markets called Riverside, which is a blend of Grenache, Mourvèdre, Mataar, and Shiraz. That wine sells here in the US for under $20. We make the 16 we're selling now, we make 3,000 cases of. The 15 that was in the Spectator Top 100 last year, we made 2,000 cases of. So even our volume wine is still pretty small.
What do you need to expand volume? You need more grape sources, you're happy where
really
you're
at? We need to. It's funny,
but do the finances and all that work for you? That's always a challenge. But if you get things going at that level, I mean, you can where you want it.
Only if we can find a vineyard that we think is appropriate for what we want, because we don't. It's funny. We had a situation just a few weeks ago where a very dear friend of mine, sadly, is quite ill. And instead of making wine, he's going to sell his crop. So he came to us and asked if we wanted to buy it. And we were pretty keen because the 18 vintage looks like volume would be down a bit just naturally, you know.
Right.
And Callum and I thought about it for a week or two and then finally had to say to him, look, mate, we'd love your fruit. We love the way you run the vineyards like we do. But we didn't do it. And that doesn't therefore fit our ethos that we actually want to, exactly, you know, make the wines, exactly, ourselves, right, in the vineyard. So
listen.
And we're not in a hurry to grow anyway.
Right.
But I think another point of difference as well is the vineyards that we're dealing with. I mean, so I went and worked away in 2013. You know, I travelled through Burgundy a bit. I went down south and to Provence. And what I loved was, even, you know, within the Rhone Valley, you've got these different appellations and the wine styles are completely different. The tradition, the culture is completely different. And I loved that. I really, really loved it. And this is when I was just getting into wine, starting to understand what it was all about.
It was a good education.
Yeah, it was incredible. Yeah. And then I came home, you know, and a lot of people, give or take, there's a lot of the same style of wine being made to an extent. There's definitely not the difference that you've got if you go from Cote Rôtie to Hermitage.
Or right, from Hermitage to Saint-Joseph or Cornac. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, and each region.
You know, I saw that in the sub-regions we've got in the Barossa, we could do that. We could make these different.
Your eye is more towards that.
Absolutely.
And take advantage of the
six
diversity.
Single vineyard wines that we have are all from different districts throughout the Barossa and Eden Valley. You know, they've got different soil types, they've got different elevation, everything. So they really are quite different wine styles. You know, we didn't want to just produce six wines all from the same little pocket of Barossa that look more or less the same. We want a big diversity of what we do.
Right. So we're in the United States. You guys are here visiting for the festival. We're talking to David and Colin Powell. Where and can we find your wines? I mean, it may vary by market. I'm heading back to New York in a few days.
We sell the wines. It's a process, slow process we're going through. So we sell the wines in New York.
Okay. New At York retail State. Or a restaurant or both?
Both.
Okay.
We probably very selected because we don't have a lot.
Right. You have to curate who you're going to.
And then we're in Massachusetts, so Boston and all of Massachusetts. We're here in Florida.
Okay.
We've just signed up with a new agent distributor in California. Only yesterday, funnily enough, you come to Florida and sign up with an old friend of mine who's now in Chicago. So we've now got Illinois.
It's all happening.
And we're hoping to get Texas next week. But that'll probably be it. You know, with tour break, I used to
you
be 46
You won't be able to
states.
Handle, right.
Yeah, so we don't want to. And even, you know, when the guy we met yesterday, old friend of mine, and he said, oh, how much volume? You know, I don't want you telling me how much, you know, you want all this volume to come into Illinois. And I told him, and he sort of just laughed. He said, I'll take it all. He's sort of like, right. Oh, that's it? Oh, okay, no worries.
Yeah. Can I twist your arm a little?
So,
I'll take it. Where do I back the truck up? I wanted to ask you this before I let you go. Australia was very much in favor as a wine-growing country, very popular here. You know, my perspective is from the U.S., even though it's, you know, a global thing.
Mm-hmm.
Very hot for a long time. And then it seemed like it fell out of favor.
Oh, fell off a cliff, didn't we?
And, you know, it's not a coincidence, I guess, you know, you leaving Torbrick, you know, and it didn't help. But why did the wine get so hot and fall out of favor? Was it quality? Was it marketing?
No.
Was it vinted over the top? Or
there's a combination of factors. First of all, there was a lot of people chasing the scores. Which I never did, ironically. I always made the wines
You wanted to make.
But there was a lot of people chasing the scores. There was a lot of those big, gloopy, syrupy, boring wines, a lot of residual sugar, intentional or added sugar for the North American palate or market. The scores just got ridiculous, where too many wines got big scores, and it got to the stage where it just ended up being a carte blanche for everybody.
But that's Parker style, too. You know, he loved the big, voluptuous Napas.
Yeah, he did. But
he was a big Rhone guy, and he loved
the big... Wine. I mean, Bob,
no, I know.
Bob, I
Which
had
is
a lot
okay,
of time
but
for it.
Everybody makes that same wine.
You've got to remember, I'm not going to bite the hand that feeds me. Bob made me. Before Bob reviewed my wines, nobody wanted to know. Well, not nobody, but once Bob reviewed Torbrick, it was like, off we went. Australia did it to itself. You've got to remember, Australia did it to itself. There was one guy in particular, actually, who did most of the damage. A guy called Dan Phillips, a company called The Grateful Palate. And he was making that. He was in cahoots with one of the guys, the guy called Jay Miller. And, you know, there was a guy on the New York Times wrote an article once about how Jay Miller had scored 90 of Dan Phillips's wines over 92 points, and Dan Phillips had one winemaker making all the wines. They're just putting different labels on them, basically.
That's a good story.
And that really killed. That was the story that broke the camel's back. And then at the same time, we had the GFC.
Right.
But trends don't last. You know, then it became Spanish wine. I think that was over. Then it was South American wine. And you've got to be very careful of trends. And that's why I've never followed the trend, because you've got to be very, very careful.
The point is make the wines you want to make, not follow the trend.
But it's also, you know, what your mum and dad would always tell you, you know, don't put all your eggs in the one basket. And I could see the US, for us as a market, starting to weaken. So I spent a lot of time in Asia. So we developed good markets in Hong Kong and China and places like
that. Those are great emerging markets.
So when the US dropped, we had somewhere else for the wine to go.
Right.
But I realised it was never going to... I mean, it was like feeding frenzy. The Parker reviews had come out and people would go, just bang, everything just went overnight. It was just crazy stuff. But I knew that wasn't going to stay forever.
So that was the bad news. The good news is there's sort of interest in Australian wine.
Absolutely. People coming back to the world.
On my show, I have a lot of sommeliers and other winemakers, authors. I had Josh Green, who's the editor and publisher of Wine and Spirits.
Yep, yep.
We did a review of the year, and I said, talk to me about, you know, exciting trends. And unsolicited, he talked about Australian wines. A friend who was on the show, Sev Peru, she owns the Ten Bells, a cool wine bar. Yep. She's in Australia for a couple of months, Instagramming every day, you know, just talking about, you know, how great it is. So those are the real cheerleaders and the real influencers. So do you agree that the path back
Absolutely.
Is there?
I've been back in the market here in the US for a couple of years now. I come, you know, every 6 months. And you can really see it. And the nice thing is for us is I think the style we're making, especially a lot with Callum's influence, sort of perhaps trying to curb some of my bad habits, we are making wines that have a freshness and a, you know, great acidity and lightness on their feet. And they're still Gros wine, don't get me wrong. We're not.
But that's part of the history of where the grape and the style of wine is.
But we happen to be, I think we're just right on song for where we need to be, the sort of wine. Everybody we're talking to is saying to us, well, this is what Australian wine should be. Now, we're not the only ones making those sort of wines, trust me. Something like the Brossa, it's a bit harder because it's a bit warmer. You've got to work a bit harder not to... That's the irony. Once upon a time, the Brossa was the easy place to get fruit ripe, make big wines and stuff like that. Now it's a place we've got to be careful that we don't end up with too big wines. It's one of those, like, it can be, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't. But it certainly is possible. So.
Right. You know, I've been on the website, Callum, and, you know, it does a good job articulating... You know, your vision and what
good
you're doing.
He wrote it.
Yeah. Well, no, I that's why I'm looking at him.
Yeah.
Not you.
Yeah,
you probably don't even remember your password.
Mate, I haven't even looked at it. Okay. The pictures.
So I think we intrigue some people by having you guys sit here and talk about your wines. If they do want to jump on the website, tell me the address.
Sure. It's just www.powellandsons.com.
And spelled out.
Yeah, exactly.
Andsons.com. And all the wines are, you know, on there. The history talks about you guys, your vision, and all of that. So if you want to know more about Powell and Son. David, I'm curious with you, when you're not drinking your wines or even wine or wine, what else do you drink?
Well, when I'm not drinking wine, I revert to my roots and drink rum and Coke. So I'm
okay. That's what I'm looking for.
Which is why I'm feeling like shit this morning.
Okay.
I think I was still drinking rum and Coke.
Guy comes to a wine festival.
I was still drinking rum and Coke. A few hours ago. So, you know.
But what else?
When I drink wine, look, from everywhere, I'll drink anything. I probably don't have the curiosity that Callum has anymore because, I mean, I'm a bit of an old dog. But give me a great bottle of Rhone wines, Burgundy, Northern Italian. You know,
anything good anywhere.
Yeah, great German, Austrian whites. You know, there's, you know.
You're drinking more for pleasure. You're drinking more for research.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah, you want to see what's going on.
And that's a great thing.
You're looking to get a buzz. You're looking to get education.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
Well, I don't drink as much anymore either. I'm getting old. You know, I can't drink as much. Well, I don't want to drink as much. So it's funny, we were actually in California just recently with Dan Freeman, a friend of ours, who I think you've been in touch with.
Dan, the PR guy.
Yeah,
great
he's
guy.
A dear friend of mine.
He's a very big cheerleader of you guys.
Well, he's an old friend, but Dan,
he articulates what's going on well.
Well, he used to work with Kermit Lynch. Yeah. You know, Dan's old school.
He's got the chops.
But he invited us to a tasting in LA with a whole group of Soms the other night, and we'd had, 37 St. Joseph's from the 15 vintage.
Which I love St. Joseph's.
Oh, so do I. It was quite an interesting tasting. With a blind tasting. Usual thing. Cheapest wine got number one. The most expensive wine everybody thought was crap.
Do you remember?
No, I'm not going to say, no.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing was Callum and I tasted together, and we worked out it's the first time we've ever actually done that sort of tasting together.
Really?
Because I did it back in the day, and people used to ask me to show judge, and I said, no, that'd take the fun, suck all the fun out of it. But Callum's done a lot of that stuff, obviously, with college and all of his mates at college, but we'd never done it together, so it was actually quite fun
That's
for
fun.
Us.
That's fun.
To go
you
through.
You
got to
do it more, right?
Mm. Yeah, and we were surprisingly close, not on everything, but...
Yeah, that was interesting, actually. That was interesting.
Yeah, you got to get out and do more of those. What happens after you leave the festival? I mean, are you staying in the States a little, do some business, and then head back?
We're here in this area, around here in Tampa and so on, to do some sales stuff, the usual dog and pony show. Then we're Texas, hopefully, to get a new distributor, then on to New York, then up to Eastern Canada, so Toronto, Montreal, then we go into
Good
Europe.
Markets.
And yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It'd be nice if the government stayed out of it. Yeah, if you get in, they could.
I know.
But and then we're on to Europe and then stopping in Asia on the way home. So and hopefully we'll get home before harvest starts. Otherwise, one of the two will toss a coin.
Yeah, with the way the weather's going at the moment, I'm not too sure.
Excuse me.
So you're not going to be back for a few weeks, it sounds like.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
For a little while, yeah.
Well, listen, I want to thank you guys for sitting with me. I think the story is great. I haven't had a chance to taste the wine. I won't be disingenuous and say, oh, your wines are great. But, you know, when I heard you were here and you'd come on the show, I went into overdrive and, you know, got the story straight. And I'm very curious to taste the wines. I'd love to do that. So I wish you guys success, continued success. Hope to see you again. I don't know if and when I'm getting to Australia. But yeah, I think I want to come to your part of town and maybe party a night with you before I go home. So we've been talking to David and Callum Powell from Powell and Son Wines. And again, we want to thank them. And you've been listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization, driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.